Has this ever happened to you? You put some money in a savings account with a great rate. But that promotional savings rate came crashing down. You deserve better. Take just 5 minutes and open a Capital One savings account online. You'll get one of the nation's best rates that's not a promotional rate. Welcome to Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet?
For consumers only. Offered by Capital One N.A. member FDIC. Copyright 2017 Capital One.
Edition of the Back Nine Report. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and checking on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alvader, but you know that sometimes he says I'm just going to sell it to you like he sells it to me. You know, he's sacrificing for the good of the show. So he's somewhere around the States playing golf, having a hard time because that's for the benefit of the show. So we need somebody who can fill in his shoes and better. And that is our European guru, colleague, and friend, Kieran Clark. Kieran, welcome to the show again. Thank you for being here.
Well, my pleasure, Carlos, as always. And as you say there, Fred leaves some very large shoes to try and fill, but I'll do my best to fill those shoes and try and impart some thoughts on the Solheim Cup. Obviously, a big win for the United States there, but a really entertaining 3 days, I think, in Iowa. It was really good fun to watch. Obviously, the FedEx Cup begins this week in the PGA Tour. Obviously, all the rich guys chasing even more money. So, there's a lot to discuss, Carlos. I'm looking forward to it. So, let's get on with it then.
Well, they're big shoes. He's a tall guy, you know, so that's why it's not anything else. It's just that he's a little tall, but that's about it. But anyway, I first of all have to say hello to a good friend of mine from back from work who's listening to us. And I said I had to say hello. So Cynthia, hi, how are you? Thank you for being listening to the show. Hope you enjoy it. We have a lot to talk about, and Kieran is going to be here carrying me because he is the expert. I'm just here to support him, and I'll try to do that. But yeah, you mentioned it. I mean, we're going to be talking about Solheim Cup. We're going to be recapping also Wyndham Championship, last tournament on the PGA Tour regular season. Kieran's going to have an excellent insight on the European Tour results. There were three tournaments there, so there's a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about the Dick's Sporting Goods, where there was news then Bernhard Langer didn't win, but there was somebody else that is also making noise there. So we have all about that. We're going to talk. We're going to have Fred. You know that he can never be away from the show. I mean, he's out, but he leaves his imprint somehow. So our VIG, very important guest of the week, is Ben Wright, and he has that interview. So we have it taped for you. So, hey. And also, on the practice range, our main topic. Well, this is, Kieran, I know this is one of the topics that you like to talk most about, and that is the FedEx Cup. I'm not going to say that you like to talk good about it, but you like to talk about it, right?
Yes.
So we'll get to talk about the FedEx Cup. So anyway, let's start with our weekend backspin. And what about the Solheim Cup? I mean, let me start off by congratulating Team USA for winning the 2017 Solheim Cup. They did it in a convincing way, 16.5 to 11.5 score. But, hey, don't let the score fool you. I mean, both teams played some of the most exciting golf we have seen in a very long time. The Sunday single matches included an epic battle between Anna Nordqvist and Lexi Thompson that we will not be forgetting anytime soon. There were no losers out there this week, but this was a big win for the LPGA and women's golf. In the end, Julie Ingster's Team USA were just too strong for Annika Sørensen's Team Europe, and the Solheim Cup will stay with the USA. They should never seem to be in doubt from the beginning as Team USA jumped to a 5.5 to a 2.5 lead over Team Europe after Friday's foursome and four-ball matches, and they never looked back. When they won 5 of the 8 available points in team play on Saturday, giving them a 10.5 to a 5.5 lead, the issue was all but over, definitely. Going into Sunday single matches, Team USA just needed 3.5 of the total of 12 available points to keep the Solheim Cup in the U.S. So the teams shared the 12 points on Sunday there in Des Moines, Iowa. And USA comfortably maintained their 5-point advantage to win, like I said, 16.5 to an 11.5 points. Again, I mean, I can't say this enough. Lexi Thompson and Anna Nordqvist, they had the game of the day of the tournament. I mean, I think the match of the year eventually ended in a tie. That match should go, I insist, should go down as one of the best in Solheim Cup history. The Swede was up 4-4. But had to birdie the last to half after world number two Lexi Thompson played a 7-hole stretch in 8-under par. Incredible in the back nine. I mean, the action in that match, it was like everybody was pinning it near the cup. I mean, it was so great action. But the cup at the end was won by Lisette Salas, who beat England's Jody Ewart-Chatoff by 1-hole. And, you know, European captain and 10-time major winner, Annika Sörenstam, she made an honest assessment. She said, and I had to agree with her, she said, "We just got outplayed and there's no doubt about it," end of quote. The USA now leads 10-5 after 15 Solheim Cups. They have won two in succession after Europe won in both 2011 and 2013. And it was Julie Inkster's second Solheim Cup win as a captain in a row. So, Kieran, what is your take on the Solheim Cup, and what do you think were the keys to the win by Team USA? After that, we'll talk about Team Europe.
Yeah, Carlos, I think in the end, obviously initially it was just extremely entertaining to watch, but Team USA were obviously big favorites coming in. They were defending champions. They were really dominating in the world rankings. A lot of players in really good form. Obviously, a lot of experience in that team, but obviously some of the rookies coming in, they were very good players as well. Daniel Kang, obviously, being a major champion coming in for her first appearance. So a very strong team, but obviously that doesn't guarantee success, as we've seen in the past. But I think this week, Julie Inkster created an environment where the players enjoyed themselves, had fun. It's perhaps less intense in the team than maybe it has been in previous years. And I was at King's Barnes for the Women's British Open when the teams were confirmed there, and Julie Inkster there confirmed that kind of thought in her head where she wanted to create a team environment, a fun environment for the players to go out and enjoy themselves and express themselves on the course, and they did that. I think in terms specifically, obviously they played really well as a team, but I think individually as well, the rookies were really strong. I think that was important for them. 6.5 of the points that they accumulated came from the rookie players, Austin Ernst, Angel Yin, and of course Daniel Kang, who was really one of the star players from either team. She was a fantastic performance from her all week. Obviously won the LPGA Championship this year. Now she's kind of building on with her career to become a real top player. And I think you saw this week a real indication she can now carry that success from earlier this year onwards and become a big star. But obviously as well, I think the four-ball sessions, obviously their strength has always been in the foursomes, getting points there. Obviously, they had a really good start on Friday, but the rest has bounced back for a 4-0 win in the afternoon session on Friday, and that was a massive kind of momentum shift, a big change there, a big confidence boost, and a real kind of knife in the heart for Europe. And if you remember the Ryder Cup last year, when the Americans went out and won 4-0 in the first session, I think just dominating a session like that is psychologically so damaging for the opposite team, but also a massive boost for their own team. And obviously on Saturday as well, they won the four-ball session 3-1. So that was 7 points from just that one format in the week. And obviously that's always been the American strength, but to really go out there and dominate that was a massive thing. If you had the Europeans perhaps went 2-2, and half those sessions, and maybe it would be a different story. But the Americans came out and just the birdie barrage. Obviously the Brittany Whitsicker and Brittany Lang on Saturday, that was just amazing, the amount of birdies they made. And Annika, you mentioned her earlier, and she said on Saturday evening, for her team in May, I think it was 35 birdies, 2 eagles, and they still lost 3-1. What else could they do? The Americans are just so strong in that format. And obviously, in the final day, it was quite combative, it was back and forth, and it was very entertaining. The matches were generally quite close. Obviously, Europe won 6 singles matches on Sunday, so it was a good contest. I think in the end, Julie Inkster, the credit has to go to her. She created the environment for her team to come together as individuals and a team. They enjoy each other's company. She put together very strong pairings. and the players went out and performed very strongly. And obviously, also experienced players is always important. You know, Christy Kerr is, you know, lover or hater, she's got fans and haters, but she is some competitor, some player, and she thrives in this environment. She was fantastic all week. You know, Paula Creamer obviously coming in as a kind of alternate to Jessica Corda. You know, she can really, you know, she silenced any doubters. She was, you know, she was really determined and combative and just, you know, silenced the critics. So I think in the end, you know, the Emma Zetstalis, of course, as well, was paired with both rookies on Friday, and she was a good kind of help for them, kind of ease them into the week. So I think in the end, you know, the experienced players were very good overall, and the rookies contributed as well. And in the end, that's kind of the key for any team competition. If your experienced heads do well, and the rookies come in and contribute, then you have a really good foundation to have a really strong performance. So the Americans, Carlos, I was just really impressed by them individually, and as a team, they're fantastic. And you know, they played better than the Europeans, and in the end, that's the secret to winning a four-hand cup, is just playing better golf, and that's what they did.
And I'm sure most of you know that Jessica Corda and Susanne Pedersen had to pull out of the competition due to injuries. I mean, Captain Julie Inkster, she named Paula Creamer, and Captain Annika Sørenstam named Katrina Matthews the replacements. And many people questioned those choices made by the two captains. I mean, I think they went perfect. They couldn't have picked a better replacement. I was one that was really distraught when I didn't see Paula Creamer on the original team. But Katrina Matthew, I could understand why at the beginning she was in there, but when Susanne Pedersen was in there, there was no question. You had to go with the experience from Katrina, who's incredible. I mean, she was already vice captain and turned to player at the 11th hour, but hey, both replacement players played exceptionally well, with Matthews picking up 3 wins. No one on Team Europe had more. Creamer, she picked up 3 wins, and no one on Team USA had more. The big difference, like you said, it was between the two teams, was the play of the rookies. You mentioned it. You nailed it. Team Europe had 4 rookies who went 3-9-0. Team USA had 3 rookies who combined 6-4-1 record. Daniel Kang, I was saying to Fred last week, Angel Jin, those were the two that I wanted to see most from the U.S. team, especially Daniel, because Daniel Kang, she is a firecracker. I mean, I knew that she was going to come here and provide some excitement to the team that already, like you said, Julie Inkster brought them together. And there certainly seems to be a changing of the guard for the Team USA. Daniel Kang and Angel Jin appear to be players who will be joining Lexi Thompson in many future Solheim Cups. And Kang especially stood out, taking a major leadership role. And Lexi Thompson's that comeback on Sunday shows that what she's made of. And on the other side, now talking about Team Europe, the combination of Mel Reid, Jody Warshadov, Carly Masson and Carlota Siganda, they combined to go 3-12-1, which really gave Team Europe no chance of winning. Those were 4 players that I'm sure they were relying a lot of. When you turn it into your side, their equivalents of Kerr, Kramer, Kang, Salas, and Thompson have 14-3-3. And in my opinion, Christy Kerr was Team USA's MVP. She finished without a loss in her 4 matches and seemed to make every putt she had to make for 3 days. I mean, on Friday, when she had to make that last putt from 12 feet, I think there was no one anywhere in the world that didn't know that she was going to make it. She has one of the safest hands there. But Team Europe, and we're going to talk about this in a short while, but I know that there were a lot of injuries. I know Anna Nordqvist, even though her record, 3-0-1, didn't show, but she was battling mononucleosis for a whole month before starting to play here, but she played well, so her record wouldn't show that is part of it. But I don't know, the injuries, and they were just – we're going to talk about the Ladies European Tour, but I think a lot of the problems come from the lack of play that a lot of the Europeans had during the season. I mean, especially Georgia Hall, Florentina Parker, the ones that made it from the Ladies European Tour, only had 6 tournaments in that tour to play and get ready for. What's your take on what happened to the European team?
Yeah, I think it's always, we're always kind of guilty of trying to kind of overanalyze these things. When a team loses or when a team wins, we often overpraise the captains or criticize circumstances when a team loses. And often it's just a case of one team played better than the other one. But I think you're right there. Particularly with Florentina Parker, who obviously was a rookie in the Solheim Cup this year. She hasn't had a lot of experience this year in terms of playing competitive golf, and that had to be a factor for her. And obviously she had a really disappointing performance. It was a real shame for her in the end, and not really what she would have hoped for. But most of the European players, you know, obviously the likes of Charlie Hull and Julie Urshadov and Mel Reid, have been playing predominantly on the LPGA Tour for the past year or so. Even Georgia Hall has played a number of events on the LPGA Tour this year as well, and actually played quite well. And of course, she played really well at Kings Barnes during the Women's British Open. So, and she's one of the standout players for Europe as well, as we've got a rookie who's got a real big future in the game. I think she's a real rising star. So I think in the end, for Europe, it was you mentioned obviously some key players and some key experienced players. And obviously, on the American side, the experienced heads did really well consistently, apart from the likes of Stacey Lewis. But most of them did. Christy Kerr, obviously, was the head of that pack. But over in Europe, obviously, particularly Saganda and Caroline Masson, the two really solid players who have done well for Europe in the past, they didn't really turn up. You know, Mel Reid, she was a little bit unlucky. She played quite well, but ran into some very strong performers. So even if she didn't accumulate many points, she didn't play too badly, but the other two, I think, did underperform, and that was a big impact. If Europe were to come through here and succeed in America, they had to have every player, you know, at their best, you know, getting points, you know, playing at their best, and that didn't happen. You know, they had a real kind of divide in the team where, you know, the third of the team didn't really turn up, and the other ones were okay, but given you're playing a team of the strength of the USA, they had to be at their best, and they just weren't. So, you know, but obviously Charlie Hull, you know, she missed the entirety of Saturday with that kind of wrist injury that could have threatened to put her at Sunday as well, was kind of the rumour, but obviously wasn't the case. She came back in the final day and won her singles match, but obviously she's a real kind of firecracker and kind of the equivalent of Daniel Kang, I think, really, a really aggressive player, enjoys the team environment, enjoys match play. You know, Charlie's been a real kind of stalwart for the European team for the last two editions. She obviously played her part this time, but obviously couldn't, you know, have an impact on Saturday, and that was a really important session, particularly on Saturday morning as Europe tried to come back and re-establish kind of an ascendancy after the whitewash on Friday evening. That didn't happen, of course, with the US picking up 2 points in the foursome. So it was, Annika Storenstam, her hands are kind of tired. You know, obviously, Suzanne Pettersen is obviously a massive player to lose. Of course, as you say, Carlos, Katrina Matthew came in, was just exceptional. What a stand-in she was. You know, really, her last playing appearance in the Solheim Cup, she's probably going to be the next captain when we go to Scotland with Glenn Eagles in 2 years' time. But what a great way for her to bow out. But for Europe, if you look at the Lose European Tour, obviously some of the match experience that wasn't their competitive experience for some of the players. But I think in the end, you know, there was just some of them just didn't turn up. And I don't think there's really any excuses for Saganda or Masson. They play enough events. They're experienced players, and they just didn't deliver. And Europe needed to have every single player to be at their best, and they just weren't had a chance. But that said, there were some bright sparks. There were some really good performances. You know, Georgia Hall was excellent. So there were some positives for the European team. Annika, I think, handled herself excellently as a captain. The players enjoyed playing under her. She was very inspirational, having, you know, arguably the best women's player of all time, certainly over the last, you know, few decades. You know, being your captain, you know, that must be a real inspirational thing to have. So I think the Europeans, even though they lost, they had a good week overall. And on Sunday, they put a strong fight up, and they won 6 points on Sunday. And when you compare that to what happened 2 years ago when they were annihilated in the singles in Germany, then that was a positive. So I think the European team, you know, there is a changing of the guard there as well. We'll obviously have to wait to see what happens in the European Tour in the coming years. But if more players going over to America, you know, Georgia Hall's going to play on the LPGA Tour next year for full time. So I think the European team, there are some positive names coming through. So they lost, but I think they'll be in a pretty good shape for Glenn Eagles in 2 years' time, Carlos.
I certainly do, and looking forward, I see a Georgia Hall. I mean, this 21-year-old rookie went down a treat. I mean, apprehensive start, but picked up confidence every day and thoroughly deserved her 2 points. And she was just two short plays from being maybe 4-1-0. too short plays. She definitely, I love her play. She's a great player that right now the U.S. is starting to see more of her, and I think we're going to see a lot more on the LPGA from her. Charlie Hall, she's definitely a stalwart as usual right now, but she had wrist problems. But that didn't take away from her from stop beating Brittany Lang in singles on Sunday. But she got 1-1 and 1, and that's part of that future. Madeline Sackstrom, long game, definitely a step ahead of her short game early on, but she showed everyone what she's made of in that win Sunday against Austin Ernest. She's definitely another player that, after what she did in the Symetra Tour and the way that she's climbing up in the world rankings, she's another one to look forward in the future. And there's a lot of other youngsters. I know Emily Peterson, she's hugely talented, but she was a little too quick to show her annoyance. I mean, it's something that works more for her opponents than for her. She needs to mature a little bit, that shot and that 0-3-0 record. She's hugely talented, but she needs to grow up a little bit and enjoy what is team play. And of course, there's out of that of this competition was Nana Kortz-Madsen, who is another hugely individual, hugely talented individual. So I know their future looks bright, and I hope. And what we're going to talk about now, which is that there's news emerging from back rooms at this Solheim Cup that is potentially doubly good for the struggling ladies European Tour. LPGA Commissioner Mike Wan told the GolfChannel.com that he's seriously interested in helping the Ladies European Tour and has already initiated discussions with the tours coming together formally for the first time at the Aberdeen Asset Scottish Ladies Open 3 weeks ago when Wan met with the Ladies European Tour board members. Wan and his staff agreed to formulate a plan to present to LED board members before the year's end in what could potentially bring the Ladies European Tour under the LPGA's umbrella. The one said no specific plan is being worked through yet, and he's open to creative options. But the news got better because the LPGA isn't alone in wanting to let, to come to the LED's aid. Wan told GolfChannel.com that the Men's European Tour is also stepping forward to joining discussions. What makes this doubly good news is not that the LPGA and the European Tour will make competing presentations. It's that Wan and European Tour CEO Keith Pelly are coming together to formulate a joint plan. So as we reported last week, the Ladies European Tour is enduring hard times, with some members fearing the tour's collapse, with 7 events having been canceled already this season. The schedule has been pared to just 15 events, down 11 events from 6 years ago. Though it's almost September, the Ladies European Tour has staged just 6 events this year beyond the major championship. So how do you see that, Kieran, this news about these two tours coming together to help the Ladies European Tour?
Well, I think in the end, it's an essential thing because the Ladies European Tour is in a dire state of health. It's happening for a while now. It's been declining for a number of years, and this year has been obviously the worst kind of example of that. You're losing so many events, losing players to the LPGA Tour. Your players not able to put together a strong schedule, not able to really put together a decent living for themselves, unless they go and play in America, which, of course, brings with it additional costs and uncertainty and so on. So it's been a real difficult time for a lot of younger players in the Ladies European Tour. They haven't been given the platform to improve as players, and that's unfortunate. So I think in the end, we obviously don't know any specifics as to what the LPGA wants to do here. I think in the end, it's in their interest as well, because the Solheim Cup is a massive event for the LPGA. It brings in so much interest and revenue. They do want to have a really strong European side to make it a competitive match. And if it wasn't a Ladies European Tour, suddenly it becomes even harder to have two strong teams. So I think it is in their interest to get involved in that respect. The European Tour under Keith Kelly, they're trying to do different things. I think they want to try and collaborate more throughout the game within Europe, trying to encourage more interest in it through corporate-wise and so on. And that's what the LAT really needs, is just money coming in from corporate interests and so on, sponsorship, which has not been there at all. So something has to happen. Obviously, the European Tour, the chief executive was ousted really last week, so he's changed. That position has changed. A new leadership on the LE team. But again, they're the problems that are really deep to try and correct. So the LPGA coming in with this support is a great thing, but I still wait to see what they actually can deliver. I think in the end, the likelihood is the LET will become kind of satellite tour to the LPGA, which in the end it pretty much has been for several years anyway, so just unofficially. Making that official obviously perhaps offers a gateway from the LET to the LPGA tour, which would be a very positive thing for players across Europe. But in terms of trying to put together more events on the continent, that's a big challenge, because in the end, the money interest isn't there. Even men's European tour finds it hard to get tournaments across continental Europe nowadays, so it's a harder environment now, really, since the financial crash of a decade ago. The interest in golf declined from the corporate interest, and the big companies like BMW and so on are starting to withdraw from golf across Europe, so it's become harder for the men's tour to do it, so even harder for the women's tour, because there isn't quite the same level of interest in television and so on. So I think in the end, it's increased media coverage is important, greater collaboration with the LPGA Tour, where of course the LPGA has grown dramatically. You go back 5, 6, 7 years ago, the LPGA was almost in the same position the LET is in now, where it was declining, fewer events, uncertainty. So perhaps Michael Wan could wave his magic wand and save the day, but I think you'll find it harder this time with the LET. I think the problems for that are deeper than what they were for the LPGA Tour. But in the end, hopefully, whatever happens, Carlos, it's for the good of the LET, because it'll be for the good of the game, and also for the Phil Lyon Cup, which in the end, I think, has shown itself once again to be one of the marquee events on the calendar every 2 years. And this shows you once again that, team match play, Carlos, it's kind of the best format for television and golf. We should have more of it on TV, because people are watching it. I know we have the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup and so on, but let's have more match play, because team match play, because that is... sport at its best, and the Phil Lyon Cup once again was great to watch.
I certainly think that this is just going to help. This Phil Lyon Cup is just going to help a lot women's golf. I mean, it was a great event, and I don't think the ladies European Tour can go much lower than they are. Maybe, I don't know, but like you said, Michael Wan really is an incredible executive. He brought the LPGA out of really this very similar situation and that the Ladies European Tour is. So he has some experience on it. I have to agree with you that this is a different monster. It doesn't have the same, even if with the problems that he's had to promote the LPGA and to get it to the point where it is right now, which has been a real struggle competing with the PGA Tour and to get the women's to get that notice here in the States, is going to find it a little more difficult where you don't have that same TV coverage that is so much needed for the Ladies European Tour. But hey, you have two incredible executives, very innovative and very forward-thinking, in Michael Wan and Keith Pelley. If those two cannot do it, definitely, I mean, the Ladies European Tour would be, I don't know, if they can't do it, I don't foresee anybody bringing them out of where they are. So I just wish them the best and can't wait to see by the end of the year what these two great minds bring together. So any final thoughts before we keep going with our weekend pack thing?
I would just quickly kind of continue what I was saying before in terms of the team match play, which I think in the end was so entertaining this weekend. Sport is at its best when it's adversarial and combative. Two teams going head to head or two individuals going head to head. And golf doesn't really have that generally every week. Stroke play 70 holes every single week. On all tours, it becomes quite repetitive on television all the time. Every event feels the same, but this felt different. Just as the Ryder Cup does, or even the President's Cup to a certain extent. I think again we should have more of it. We should have more match play. In the end, the best stroke play events, generally speaking, almost became match play. Look at the Jewel in the Sun, or last year's Open Championship with Phil and Henrik, or even the Open this year with Stephen Kuchar, or even the Masters with Sergio and Justin Rose. Stroke play becomes exciting when it actually becomes match play, essentially. And that is the most exciting format for golf. Having a team environment is even better. Two sides going head to head is enjoyable. It's the most kind of accessible way for people to be introduced to the game on television. The Ryder Cup is the biggest event on television for the men's game, and the Solheim is the biggest event for the women's game on television. That's to show you, we should have more of that, because that's what people like to watch. Obviously, we had the Lexus Cup before. Because in the end, Carlos, surely, if we're serious about growing the game, which is an expression I hate because it's overused and it's generally quite empty, but if people were really serious about that, surely we'd have a match between South Korea, the most dominant nation in women's golf, maybe even the continent of Asia, taking on the rest of the world or the US. That would be fantastic for golf in Asia, and it would be great television for golf fans seeing the best players in the world. In the end, most of the best players in the world right now in the women's game are from Asia, and we haven't given them that platform to really show how great they are. So I think in the end, in terms of golf, obviously Keith Pelley mentioned there is trying a lot of different formats in the European Tour. I think in the end, have team match play, have a Nations Cup on the European Tour between England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. That would be fantastic. So in the end, in terms of trying to change events and trying to grow the tours, I think rather than making the game shorter or having six-hole events or par threes and different kind of things, team match play. You know, maybe have two or three more events a year just to break things up a little bit and make it different. And I think in the end, that would be a beneficial thing to the game. And I'm sure the interest would be there because, you know, when you see the Ryder Cup, when you see the Solheim Cup, even the President's Cup, you know, it is something different, and it is an exciting, aggressive form of golf we get to see, and I want to see personally more of it going forward.
We'll see what they do, and definitely match play is one of the favorite, and we have seen it. I mean, the best tournaments have been the Solheim Cup, the Ryder Cups, and I think they have got something going with the international crown, but I consider following on that you're saying, maybe a type of a female equivalent to the President's Cup that would give that other rest of the world, especially the Asian, which is the market that is growing so big right now on the ladies, especially, it would give them that platform. I would like to see that as well, maybe on the off year that the Solheim Cup is not. So maybe including, like you say, Asia against the rest of the world, because that would be like South Korea, basically, against the rest of the world. that would be incredible to see. Well, with that, we're coming to it. There was something else. There was some other tournament, the Wyndham Championship, where Henrik Stenson, he produced a superb back nine at Sedgefield Country Club to win the Wyndham Championship by a single shot from Ollie Schneider-James and claimed his first PGA Tour title since last year's Open Championship at Royal Troon. He was tied with young Schneider-James through 14 holes, but the Stensonator put his foot to the floor with three birdies in a row from the 15th. But the 24-year-old former Georgia Tech player wasn't done. He birdied the final hole to get within one of Stenson. That meant the Swede had just one shot cushion coming to the final hole. He kept his cool, though, and secured the par he needed for the victory. Stenson said, and I quote, "I had to keep on making birdies because Ollie was surely not backing down. I thought I had a two-shot cushion, and as I walked over to the 18th hole and look around, oh, okay, Schneider-James birdied as well, so I better scramble a par here to get the win," end of quote. Webb Simpson took third place ahead of three players tied for fourth, Ryan Armour, Kevin Na, Rory Sabatini. That's a name I haven't heard in a while in the leaderboards. Stenson's sixth PGA Tour title was a timely one. It just comes before the FedEx Cup playoffs get underway, and the Swede is now in a strong position to launch his bid for his second FedEx Cup title. He won it in 2013. He's now 23rd on the FedEx Cup standings, up from 75th. He has climbed to 6th on the official World Golf rankings. The other battle at Sedgefield was between those players trying to qualify for the playoffs beginning at the Northern Trust Open this week. The top 125 on the points list made it in. Jeff Ogilvy, who was number 125, finished at 11 under at Sedgefield and earned enough points to move to 116th. Martin Flores, who started 139th, jumped to 118th and made the playoffs for the first time since 2014. J.J. Henry, Harold Varner III, and Rory Sabatini also played their way into the top 125.
There were three aces during the final round there. Roberto Castro made one on the third, and Ben Crane got one on the 16th, and Martin Flores pulled his tee shot on the same hole later in the day. Other notable finishers, Shane Lowry, he made a big move to finish T7 and jump from 147 to 127, just out of the running for the Cup. Davis Love III finished T10 and missed the playoffs. Jason Duffner, T14, he's in. Russell Knox, T28, with, among others, Anib Van Lahiri, both are in. Keegan Bradley, T42, he's in. Billy Horschel, T60, he's in. Bill Haas, he made the cut but did not finish. He was in. Patty Harrington, same thing, but he was out. Luke McDonald missed the cut, but he was in. Graeme McDowell, man, surprisingly, he missed the cut, but he is out. And Ernie Els withdrew, citing a rib injury, to put an end to his season. He was 4 over through 27 holes at the time of the withdrawal. So very unfortunate for him, but he was already way out. He needed to win to make the FedEx Cup playoffs, Kieran.
Yeah, absolutely, and like you said, a great win for Henrik Stenson. It left a really exciting finish there, with Schneider Jans making a great run at the end. It was a good tournament to watch, I've got to say, and it was a nice end to the regular PGA Tour season at a really historic venue in Sedgefield. Obviously, great history there in the past, with Sam Snead winning there many times, of course, so, and Donald Ross Golf Course, so it's a good venue and a good way to end the regular season. But over on the European Tour, Carlos, we had the Paul Laurie match play, another match play event in Germany this year. A bit odd for a Scottish player to have an event in Germany, but because of sponsorship reasons, had to move to Germany rather than Scotland this year. And it was Adrian Otegi who upset the home favourite, Marcel Siem from Germany, to clinch his maiden European Tour title at the Paul Laurie match play. And the Spaniard, who's 24, he recovered from a slow start against the experienced German to record 4 birdies in a row, and to claim eventually a 2-1 victory in the final. And Otegi, who's actually come into this week with a lot of good form, he has posted 4 consecutive top 20 finishes on the tour. He's a former British boys champion, so he's been around for a long time now. And he actually trailed Siem by 3 down after 9 holes. So he was way down there looking, you know, potentially dead and buried, while Siem was hoping to triumph in front of his home fans. But Otegi recovered brilliantly, and he clinched the title in what was his 123rd start on the European Tour to get his first win. And over in the third and fourth playoff match, we had Sweden's Johan Carlsson, who defeated Alejandro Canizares, who'd actually beaten the host, Paul Laurie, earlier in the week. Carlsson won 3-2 in the final, thanks to 3 eagles in his round there, so quite a stunning finish from the Swede to pick up the third place in the Paul Laurie match play. And over on the CG International, Carlos, which was on a European Tour sanctioned event, I must say, quite a remarkable story here. We had 44-year-old Australian Jason Norris. He won by 4 shots, and it came just a week after he gave up his job, a part-time job, in a pro shop and a golf club. He gave up his job. He was earning $9,000 a year, and he gave it up. He's going to go and play golf full-time again for another couple of years to see if he could finally make it big. And a week later, he did. Quite remarkable. And the guy's also overcome a couple of near-death experiences. A few years ago, a decade ago, he actually crashed a bike, and which resulted in him actually having his nose pushed that far into his skull that he was a centimetre from death. It was that serious. And so he dodged that bullet back in the day. And then 4 years ago at a golf tournament in Australia, he caught viral meningitis, almost killed him as well. So this guy, he's in the matrix here. He's dodging all the bullets. He's at Keanu Reeves. He's invincible. He's at the Terminator. He's come back, and he's picked up his fabulous and big, big title in the Fiji International. It now gives him status on the European Tour and indeed on the Asian Tour. Big money tours, both of them. So this guy at 44, he's got a chance now to go and plot a career in Europe or in Asia, play the 2 tours, make a good living for himself, and in the end make more money than he would have done working in the pro shops. Quite a remarkable story there. And finally, Carlos, over on the Viking Challenge and Challenge Tour, our first event, this event's been on the tour, and there was Clement Sorbet from France, who cruised in the end to complete his third European Challenge Tour title. He shot a final round of 67 to win the inaugural edition of the Viking Challenge by 5 shots in the end. But the event was played over 54 holes because of heavy rain, so one of the rounds having to be cancelled in the end. So he won over 3 rounds by 5 shots. And in the end, he actually began the final day in a share of the lead, but he buried 4 of his first 6 holes to pull ahead, and that's where the Frenchman stayed for the entire day. And he moved into a commanding position. He did not give up on the back nine. And he's 24 years old, Carlos, and he's won twice before on the Challenge Tour. That came at the 2015 Northern Ireland Open and the 2016 Turkish Airlines Challenge event as well. And so he won that event quite comfortably in the end, and he now moves up 49 places and is now 14th on the road to Oman, which is also the route back to the European Tour for all these players. So he's now in 14th position. Now is a great chance to get his status in the European Tour for next year. And also moving up in those rankings were England's Charlie Ford, Dutchman Dan Huizen, who's played on the European Tour before, quite a talented player, and also Scotland's Jack Doherty, who finished 5 shots behind Sobey in second place. Those 3 players are in a really good position to potentially push into the top echelon of the road to Oman and get back onto the European Tour next season. And finally, Carlos, over on the web.com tour, on the new Sentinel Open, it was Taylor Gooch who, for the second week in a row, put together a great finish to get into a top position. A 25-year-old who, of course, used to be at Oklahoma State, he put together an amazing run on his final day to win that event. And last week, actually, on the web.com tour, he in Missouri, he shot a final on a 64 to finish second. And on Sunday there, he secured a title, the new Sentinel Open, presented by Pilot. He shot a 6-under-65 at Fox Den Country Club to finish 18-under-par for the tournament and pick up the title there. And that victory earned him $99,000 and secured his place pretty much on the PGA Tour for next season. And he also, Carlos, got to wear a very silly orange jacket for winning in a title ceremony. So, so many events nowadays, Carlos, like to have these, you know, they wear jackets. So when I get a jacket at the end, you know, Hilton Head does it and so on, and a few other ones do it too. And it looks a bit silly, but in the end, the Masters, Carlos, is the only event that you have a jacket for the champions, not the new Sentinel Open. Come on.
Have you seen the plaid jackets as well?
The plaid jackets are a bit, well, Carlos, they're just an abomination. They should be banned. They're offensive.
That's sacrilegious, right? I mean, that's just going too far. I prefer the orange jackets anytime. Hey, the other two tournaments, you know, Kieran, maybe there's something to this use a long putter but don't anchor it thing after all. For the third time this year, Scott McCarron was a winner on the Champions Tour. This time it was the Dick's Sporting Goods Open, with McCarron making birdies on the final 3 holes on Sunday to earn a one-shot victory over Kevin Sutherland. That closing 64 came after an 11-under 61 on the second round, when it appeared McCarron made every putt he looked at this year. The victory moved the 52-year-old McCarron up to second in the Charles Schwab Cup money list behind Bernard Langer, who has 4 wins this year. So between the two of them, McCarron and Langer has 7 wins on tour, including 4 of the tour's 5 majors, 3 for Langer, 1 for McCarron. What Langer and McCarron have in common is that they are both former anchoring putters, using long putters who have modified their strokes by moving their top hand away from their chest just a bit to adhere to the new USGA rules banning anchored putting. The use of such a modified putting stroke has been subject of some heated debate this summer, with some analysts saying the stroke is at best skirting the new rules. McCarron and Langer both issued statements saying they were not breaking the rules or even pushing the envelope on the anchoring ban. The putting controversy aside, I mean, and it has to be noted that no official from the Champions Tour has even hinted that Langer and McCarron are potentially breaking the rules. McCarron's 3rd win of the year reshapes the race for the Charles Schwab Cup on the senior circuit. McCarron is now 2nd on the Tour's money list with $1.7 million right now. That still puts him nearly $750,000 behind Langer, which is a massive margin given that McCarron won $300,000 for the victory now. But when the Schwab Cup playoffs start,
the money is no longer the determining factor. It becomes a point system with the points weighted for the first event based on where a player finished the regular season on the money list. That would put McCann on Langhurst's heels for the playoff, something that wouldn't necessarily be true if the title was decided strictly by money won in the regular season and the playoffs. So McCarron's huge 2017 season now gives him 5 PGA Tour champions wins and 4 second place finishes in a career that goes back only 2 years since McCarron turned 50 in the summer of 2015. And the last one, the U.S. amateur, Doug Gim, the 7th-ranked amateur golfer in the world. He played well enough to win the U.S. Amateur Championship in the 36-hole final Sunday at Riviera Country Club. He just didn't play well enough to beat a 19-year-old sophomore from Clemson, whose swing was never betrayed by the match's relentless pressure, and whose putter seemed equipped with a GPS system locked onto the bottom of the cup. Doc Reckman, who's ranked 70th and had to survive a playoff simply to make the field of 64 that started match play Wednesday, was 2 holes down with 2 holes to play when eagle birdie to force a playoff, then won the 37th hole to claim as the 117th amateur. He will now join names such as notables as Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Phil Mickelson, and Tiger Woods on the Have Mayer Trophy, but only after he survived a match in which neither golfer gave the other one more than a hint of an opening. And shortly afterward, the USGA announced the 10 U.S. Walker Cup players who will play, a team from Great Britain and Ireland, at L.A. Country Club September 9th to the 10th, which here and you and I will be talking about in a few minutes. But both, let me just end it by saying that Spider Miller, captain of the U.S. Walker team, hardly could believe what he was seeing between the two. So any final words, Kieran, before we move to the previews for this weekend?
I'll just quickly mention that Scott McCarron on the Champions Tour, you mentioned obviously his change, his putting style this year, the fitness and the new rule for the anchored putting. And it's funny because I heard him say that if they changed the rule again and actually allowed anchoring, he would not go back to it. He actually prefers the way he putts right now. And for Karen, actually has used the long putter for about 20 years. So it shows you, actually, we all kind of thought, well, would the anchored putting rule change, would that, you know, adversely affect players? Well, it's actually made Scott McCarron a better putter, remarkably. So there you go.
Yeah, especially on Saturday. I mean, he made that 60-61, and he was making putts from anywhere. I mean, put the ball outside of the green, and I think he would have putted in. So he was definitely on fire during the weekend. And there goes to show you that his results right now have been incredible and definitely play down to what you're saying. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the previews. Of course, we have the FedEx Cup that starts this weekend, but that one is for our practice range. Let's talk a little bit about the European tournaments. You have the Meeting Denmark there. You're going to talk to us about it, the Willow Senior Golf Classic and the Rolex Trophy. But Thomas Peters is going to be defending there at the Meeting Denmark, right?
Yeah, he certainly is. And obviously last year when Peters came through and won the Meeting Denmark, and that was kind of the performance that really secured his place in the Ryder Cup team last year. I think he played the first round with Darren Clark, the captain. He was so impressive, and Clark sort of thought, wow, this guy's a player. He won the event under pressure, showed Clark that he deserved to be on the team, and obviously became a real star of that team last September, particularly playing with Roy McIlroy. They had a great partnership there, and it was really exciting to watch at Hazelton. So Peters is now going back to Denmark to defend his title. Obviously, he's a brilliantly talented player. You know, had some good performances this year, perhaps hasn't quite broken through and won, maybe won the events perhaps we sort of expected him to, but he's still a young guy, can still achieve a lot, and he's one of the favourites this week. And this event, Carlos, is always really fun and colourful. There's big crowds there, a great atmosphere. It's a real kind of carnival event. It's one of the kind of the highlights of the European Tour season, I would say. The players really enjoy the event, and it's one of the best on tour. And, of course, there'll be home favourites there. You know, Søren Kjeldsen and Torbjørn Olsen. They'll be a big support this week. Those guys pick up their home open title. It'll be a great story. They'll fancy their chances. As well, of course, two-time major champion Martin Kaymer, who's also in the field. looking for his first title since the 2014 U.S. Open at Pinehurst. It seems incredible to say, given the quality of timer, just a brilliant player on his day, but hasn't quite shown it consistently over the past 3 years. But Carlos, over on the European Senior Tour, like you said there, there's the Willow Senior Golf Classic, Gary Marks from England, he won that last year. And in the field this year, you have the likes of the former Ryder Cup player Barry Lane, senior major winner Roger Chapman, and of course the very colourful, entertaining Jarmo Sandelin that they were playing this year. This event is quite a nice charitable event. It benefits the Willow Foundation, which is a charity that provides memorable days and experiences to seriously ill young adults between the ages of 16 and 40. And that charity was started by Bob Wilson, who was a former soccer goalkeeper for Arsenal FC, and his daughter died of cancer some years ago. He started this charity in her memory. And finally, Carlos, over on the Challenge Tour, is a unique event this week, is the Rolex Trophy, which is a pro-am in Switzerland with only 42 professionals in the field, so a really elite field, and some big money there, one of the biggest of the year. And it features most of the top players in the circuit this year, with one of the biggest prize funds, so it's going to be a real important week for some of those players trying to finish high up in the rankings and to qualify for next year's European Tour. So, Carlos, some great events in Europe this week.
They definitely are. So it's getting down to the nitty-gritty there on the Challenge Tour. I think it's only 9 events left, so a lot of action to follow there. On the LPGA Tour, there's action, yes, after a well-deserved week off. Well, for some of them, they had played 12 consecutive weeks. The LPGA resumes its schedule this week in Ontario, Canada, at the Ottawa Hunt and Golf Club for the playing of the Canadian Pacific Women's Open. Adiyeh Tanagran, she will be trying to defend the title she won last year when she coasted to a four-shot victory over runner-up Se-young Kim. The total purse is $2.25 million with a first prize of $337,500. All but 5 players from the Solheim Cup are playing this week. Those not in the field are Lexi Thompson, Jarena Pillar, Lisette Salas, Floating Tina Parker, and Georgia Hall. Lydia Ko, who has gone more than a year, incredible, without winning as a 3-time champion. She won her first LPGA Tour event at the Canadians Open, Women's Open in 2012 when she was 15, to become the youngest winner in tour history. Annika Sørensen won the first edition of this tournament in 2001. Ike Kim is here playing. She's the only player who has won 3 times on the LPGA Tour this year. And the LPGA Tour will have 2 more events in the U.S. before going overseas for the next 2 months. And the Canadians Women Open, this tournament, Kieran, is going to be played next year at the Wascana Country Club. So this was the last time we see it here, at least for a little while.
Yeah, obviously, again, having the LPGA Tour back is going to be great because it's obviously, obviously coming off the Solheim Cup. Obviously, some great attention in the women's game. And I think people will try and tune in this week and try and catch some of the players that they saw last week at the Solheim Cup and try and see how they get on this week, because obviously the Solheim is really the best way of trying to showcase the women's game. It kind of makes stars of the players, and I think people will be interested to see how they get on in Canada this week.
So how about there's going to be action on the Champions Tour, right? You're going to tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes, the Bowling Classic on the Champions Tour.
Yes,
yes, obviously we have heard Scott McCarron, of course, winning last week in brilliant fashion. Obviously, one of the long putter users, who of course has been, as you say, Carlos, kind of controversial in that respect. But I think somewhat unfair. I think in the end, the whole issue of anchored putting has been really kind of overblown, and some of the guys who have been talking about it really should know better, because in the end, these guys, Langer and McCarron, they're clearly not cheating. They've proven that over the year. It's a very marginal difference. They're only playing with the rule as it is. If you don't like it, then that's just the way it is. You have to change it. That's the rule as written. Those guys are complying with that. And they're playing, they're doing the right thing, so that's and it's worked for them. So, yes, the Bowling Classic. It's obviously a long-established event on the tour, and of course Bernard Langer won it last year, surprise, surprise. And he'll be looking, of course, to defend that title this week. Langer, who, as he keeps saying, he keeps defying the odds, he keeps showing us that age is just a number. He you know, the gospel doesn't know how old he is. You know, he's coming up now for his 60th birthday. So he's now an experienced player on the Champions Tour, and he's still making records. He's still a man to beat. You know, Scott McCarron's also there as well, but you know, Langer's still, he's the guy to beat. And Langer actually turns 60, I believe, on the final day of the Boeing Classic this year. So when you put it like that, Carlos, he's pretty much guaranteed to win, I think.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, unless he says he's not going to win it, then that's not going to happen. But I forgot to mention also on the ladies in the LPGA that qualifying school stage one is being played this week, the first step in the grueling process of trying to earn LPGA and or Symetra Tour membership begins this week with the LPGA qualifying school stage at Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage in California. It's a 72-hole stroke play competition that begins this Thursday, continues through Sunday. And it's a record to field size of 362 players that will be competing to advance to the Stage 2, which will take place at the Plantation Golf and Country Club in Venice, Florida. And that would be in October. But the important thing is that the interest in becoming an LPGA Tour member has grown tremendously over the last four years, and that is best exemplified in the number of players competing. I mean, in 2013, there were 247 signed up for Stage 1. Then by 2015, 2 years after, that has reached 283. The tour was forced to add a third golf course because of the size of the field last year. Right now, as you see, is 362 players. So that's 115 more in a span of 4 years. So definitely there's a lot of interest in getting into the LPGA. But to finalize our four call quick previews, this is it on the web.com tour. It has reached its apex for this regular season as the tour rolls into Portland, Oregon for the Winco Foods Portland Open presented by Kraft Heinz, the final event before the web.com tour finals. It will be played on the Witch Hollow course at the Pumpkin Ridge Golf Club in North Plains, Oregon. It's the last chance for those on the outside of the top 75 on the money list to make the big move and lock up their jobs on the web.com tour for next year. The total purse will be $800,000 with a first prize of $144,000 that should secure the winner a spot in the coveted top 25, which earned their automatic cards on the PGA Tour for next season. And for those outside the 25, the largest purse during the tour's regular season affords anyone the chance to make a big move. Take Ryan Brehm, last year's winner, and Mark Anderson, last year's runner-up, for example. Brehm was 30th on the money list heading into Portland a year ago, but his victory catapulted him all the way to fourth. And Anderson, thanks to his solo second result, moved from 51st to 14th. A lot is on the line this weekend, Kieran, on the Pacific Northwest. But one thing for certain is it's going to be fun watching them trying to make that top 25 and the top 75. Any final words on the previews before we go to our Par 5 news?
No, Carlos. I think we're good to go for the Par 5 news. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about, so let's keep it going.
I can't wait for this opening piece on the Par 5 news, where every week we pick five pieces of news. And this one, I had to put it on top because I don't care if Tiger Woods was found with medicine in his blood. I'm tired of talking about that. I don't care about anything else. But Dame Laura Davis is going to play on the European Senior Tour. Now you have to tell me everything about that. What's going on there?
Well, the thing is, you know, Carlos, you know, let's be honest here. Dame Laura Davis should be able to go anywhere she wants and play anywhere she wants. You know, she's a legend. She's the greatest. She's, you know, the game's great ambassador and best personality, yeah, and the most, you know, the most opinionated and talkative, and she's the best interview in golf. And, you know, she's going to play on the European Senior Tour next year, which seems crazy, but she'll play with all the old guys and she'll show them how it's done. And obviously, you know, Dame Laura is a four-time major champion, world golf hall of famer. you know, Solheim Cup legend, and she'll take part in next year's Shipro Masters in Denmark, and will play from the same tees as the over 50 men, which will include former Masters champion and former world number one Ian Woosnam. So Dame Laura will make history being the first woman to play on the men's European Senior Tour, and she said, and I quote, "My golfing career has been played in parallel with a number of players who are currently on the Senior Tour, so I'm really looking forward to testing my wits against them. It is a privilege to be invited back to Simmons Golf Club, and I'm looking forward to making history on the Senior Tour next year." So in the end, Carlos, the Senior Tour, it's golfers 50 and over, you know, not about men or women. It's just, you know, Dame Laura, you know, she, as we saw at the Women's Open, Women's British Open at King's Barnes on the first day particularly, where, you know, she can still play. She hits the ball so far still. When she starts holding putts, she can still put together some really good scores. So I tell you what, Carlos, you know, all these old guys, you know, Woozy and all the rest of them, they better watch their back, because, you know, Dame Laura is going to come onto the scene next year. And I wouldn't be surprised if she was right there in contention in the final day, because, you know, she loves playing, she loves competing, and, you know, she would love nothing more than to make history even more than by winning the European Senior Tour. So I can't wait to see that, because we've had things in the past where Annika played the Colonial, you know, Michelle Wee played men's events when she was a teenager, but I think in the end, you know, this Dame Laura, that's going to surpass all that. You know, I'm looking forward to that next year. It's going to be great.
Totally. I can't wait. I can't wait. It's going to be June 1st to the 3rd, 2018. I have it marked already in my calendar. I think there are going to be guys that are not going to be able to outdrive her. So
yes.
I think she is going to be, that's going to be, you got to be here on the show to talk about this next year for sure. I mean, this is something big time. I can't wait to see that. It's great for her. It's more to her illustrious career. Oh, man, I can't wait. I'm pumped. I'm so sad that it's not this year. So sad. But anyway, let's talk about the Walker Cup. The Walker Cup match is a biennial amateur team competition between the USA and a team composed of players from Great Britain and Ireland selected by the RNA. The match is played over 2 days with 18 single matches and 8 foursomes, which played alternate shot matches. The USA leads the overall series 35-9-1, but the teams have split the last 14 meetings since 1989, so it's very close. And Doc Redman and Doc Gim, which we talked about in the results of the U.S. Amateur, squared off Sunday at Riviera, but they will return to L.A. in a few weeks as teammates. Both U.S. Amateur finalists were named as part of the 10-man U.S. Walker Cup team that will take on Great Britain and Ireland September 9 to the 10 at the Los Angeles Country Club. In the championship match, as I said, Redman defeated Gim in 37 holes. Also named to the Walker Cup team, NCAA champion Braden Thornberry, Hogan Award winner Maverick McNeely, Western Amateur champion Norman Seong, and CalStart calling Morikawa. Cameron Champ, the long-hitting senior at Texas A&M, and Scotty Scheffler and Will Salatoris, a pair of USGA champions, also will represent Team USA. Stuart Hagestad, 26-year-old, is the lone mid-amateur representative. The USGA announced earlier this year that it was scaling back its mid-amateur requirement from 2 players to 1, but U.S. Captain Spider Miller had previously suggested that 2 mid-amateurs would be on this year's team if they played well enough to deserve a spot. Then, somehow, College Player of the Year was left off the U.S. Walker Cup team, and this has a lot of people upset and asking for a change in the selection process. Among those left out were Sam Burns, who earned the Nicholas Award as a top player in college golf, and recently tied for 6th in a PGA Tour event. Meet amateur Scott Harvey, who was part of the 2015 Walker Cup team, and Illinois senior Dylan Merker, ranked number 4 in the world. The response on social media, especially from
especially from players, from pro players and members of the golf media, was immediate and in amazing support of Barnes. Remember, Barnes is a former U.S. amateur champion as well. The thing here is that the USGA's International Team Selection Committee does not make its points list public, and no USGA official was made available for a comment Sunday to discuss how the roster was constructed, which along the big snubs are the reason enough to call for at least a revision of the selection process. The U.S. leads the overall series, like I said, 13-5-9-1, but the Americans come from suffering their worst ever defeat 2 years ago at Royal Lithium. And McNeely, Maverick McNeely, is the lone returning member from that squad. And I hope this works out for Team USA. Otherwise, Kieran, I already hear Phil Mickelson calling for a committee here as well.
I think Phil Mickelson will actually become the World Cup captain next time if that happens. He wants to get involved in everything, doesn't he? But, you mentioned actually Maverick McNeely being the only player from the American team back from last time. He's the only player from both teams from last time still playing in the amateur game. The rest of them are all either professionals or didn't qualify. It's been a remarkable turnaround. And for the European, for the GB and I World Cup team, it's incredible where in the past they were kind of career amateurs, Gary Wolstenholme or Peter McEvoy, who played in so many Walker Cups, but nowadays, you know, it's a one-and-done sort of thing, where all 10 members of the team are rookies. I've never played in it before, so it's a completely different team for GB and I this year in LA, and, but it's a very good team that as well, and there's some kind of recognisable names. People will, of course, will remember the oldest player in the team is Alfie Plant, who is 25, and of course he was a silver medalist, the low amateur, for the Open Championship at Royal Birkdale, where he was supported by his family and friends were there, a big atmosphere, and of course his name's Alfie Plant, and his girlfriend's called Daisy, I think it is, so she'll be called Daisy Plant if they ever get married, and that created a lot of jokes, obviously, plants and flowers and all that sort of stuff. So Alfie Plant is the oldest player in that team. For GB and I, two of the other players are 20, four more are 21, two are 22, and one of them is 23. And in addition to Plant, some of the more kind of established names are the reigning British amateur champion Harry Ellis, former amateur champion Scott Gregory. They're two of the other standout names. Matthew Jordan, who won the St. Andrews Links Trophy, which is a big event earlier this year, he's also in the team. And Conor Syme from Scotland, who played so well at the U.S. Amateur, he reached the quarterfinals there. He will also be on the Walker Cup this year. And as you said, Carlos, you know, the JB and I had an incredible result 2 years ago, but of course a completely different team. So who knows what's going to happen this year? But it's a pretty good team we've got, and I'll go through it now in its entirety. So there's also David Boot, Jack Davidson, Paul McBride, Robert McIntyre, Jack Singh Brar. They complete the 10. In terms of reserves, there's Conor O'Rourke and Craig Howie, in case anyone drops out, much as we saw at the Solheim Cup. So, you know, Carlos, the Walker Cup obviously has a great history to it. You know, so many of the games, great players have played in it for either side, have kind of emerged through that and have gone to win majors and be really top professionals. So it's always worth following because, you know, any of these young guys who are playing for either team, you know, maybe in the future, they could be the next Justin Thomas or the next Dustin Johnson or the next Rory McIlroy. You just never know because they're all very talented. They're all emerging players, all young players, and a good week here could really push them on having potentially great careers when they eventually turn pro.
Definitely, that's a good way to see it. I mean, and it's showcasing their talents. Otherwise, you know, it's like a preview of what we could see maybe in the future in Ryder Cups or President's Cup for these type of players. So we'll see what goes on, but it's definitely, certainly in the U.S. at least, I think there should be something done about the selection process. I mean, that part of Sam Burns being snubbed is something that I need the USGA to help me understand it. I don't get it, but, well, we'll see how that goes. Hey, talking about the Olympics, the golf in the Olympics, 1 year later, has been a change. Let's talk a little bit about that. As a catalyst for change, India's Aditi Ashok, she didn't exactly look as if she'd been plucked from central casting. Golf's return to the Olympics last fall for the first time in over a century was billed in some circles as the ultimate Grow the Game initiative, a chance to transform a sport that had long been considered the realm of the wealthy in many parts of the world into a bona fide competition worthy of nation's best. In theory, the proponents explained a chance to compete for medals at the Olympics would elevate golf in the eyes of many, which would generate interest and potential funding. In practice, it was the shy, rail-thin Ashok who stood as the standard bearer when the 18-year-old carted a second Route 68 to move into contention at the Olympics women competition and became the example of golf's Olympic reach. I mean, prior of her going to the Olympics, back there, the Indian Golf Union had no interest, from the government. It was categorized as an elite sport, supposedly played by wealthy people, but after the Olympics and following Aditi's performance in the early part of the event, then the Indian government has started to look at golf through different eyes and is now considering it to be a medal prospect for the country in the future. But her impact in golf in India, where an estimated 1 in 10,000 people play the game, was predictable. A year removed from the Olympics golf return, it has resonated beyond the Rio leaderboard. In underdeveloped golf countries, the Olympics provide a unique opportunity to educate the public, which a recent International Golf Federation study suggests goes beyond the reach of even the game's majors and other marquee events, as well as a chance to leverage the game's newfound status as an Olympic sport. From China to Chile, national golf organizations have enjoyed an influx of interest and support that is unprecedented. I mean, in Argentina, they've been able to gain funding for their National Olympic Committee for their elite amateurs, which they wouldn't have had before. That was in China. You all know what we have been said about China and their golf, how they have been thinking about it, but they have changed. Now they have primary schools and high schools that have golf-specific development programs to create an elite pathway right up to professional golf. And that is thanks to what Chongqing Fang did winning the bronze medal. And, of course, now how other Chinese players are doing, especially on the men as well. Not as great as Chongqing Fang, but, hey, that has increased them dramatically. Prior to those games, Anthony Scanlon, from the IGF executive director, explained that golf was part of a sports ministry in China called the Small Balls Department. That's how denigrating they call them, which was mainly for non-Olympic sports. Now, that is under its own umbrella. The opportunity for growth and support has increased dramatically. That is the power of a potential Olympic medal in countries where coming in third at the games, which China's Chongqing Fang did, could generate more interest than winning a major. That's what we have been saying about this. It's been producing. Although many of the giant golf made in places like Argentina and China are anecdotal since last year's Frozen Zimmerman, it's a potential support and recognition that has created optimism among administrators. Even in places that didn't send golfers to Rio, the games have created opportunities that weren't there before the Olympics. Like in my native Puerto Rico, where the island's Olympic Committee has provided about $25,000 in funding for its golf association. Never heard before. Ever. That would have never happened. It's not a lot, but it helps offset some of the expenses they have to travel for championships and prepare themselves. I mean, they have seen what funding that we didn't see before. I mean, they are encouraged down there. But if financial benefits created by the games are encouraging, the interest among a largely non-public golf has generated more optimism. The spike in interest in golf around the games surprised even those who preach the mass appeal of the games' return to the Olympic stage. That's including me. You all know how much I was for it. According to a recent study, there were more than 650 hours of golf coverage globally that reached more than 285 million households. More telling, however, was an IGF study that measured fan engagements via social media. Golf ranked as the seventh best Olympic sport in fan engagements with more than 190,000, just ahead of boxing and behind diving. Swimming was first, of course, with more than 780,000 engagements. And if you don't know, engagements were defined as any social media post specific to a particular sport and included a four-month window, 2 months before and a month after the games. To put that into context, that put Olympic golf ahead of every major played since 2013, and only behind the 2014 Ryder Cup. That is the context that you have to see. So, you know, unlike at the Rio Games, the actual logistics of the Olympics becomes more easier for golf moving forward, with established courses already in place for 2020 in Tokyo and in Paris in 2024, which will likely be named the site for the 2024 Games in September at the IOC's executive board meeting in Peru. But, you know, those tasks with running golf's Olympics dream into reality, Kieran. The challenge moving forward is how the game leverages unparalleled attention into more resources and grassroots interest in the underdeveloped countries. With golf now firmly established in the Olympic rotation, officials are now recognizing that the key to continued change will come from the most unlikely places, like that 18-year-old Aditi Achak, who captivated a nation with her play. That is what gets golf really growing, Kieran.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Carlos. I think in the Olympic Games, it really changed the perception of golf for many people in developing parts of the world, for Africa and Asia and so on, South America. I think that was a massive thing for the game. I know people were quite cynical about it all in terms of the format and whatever else, but I think in the end, that was a really good showcase for the game, the ultimate kind of way to present golf to a new audience, new potential players, and that can only be a good thing. I'm sure when we go towards Tokyo in a few years' time, that will only increase. And of course, in Tokyo, we're going to a country where golf has really developed, and one of the great superstars of golf, potentially, in Hideki Matsuyama, could be the real flag bearer for his home nation when we go there in a few years' time. So, yeah, golf in the Olympics is all looking pretty good there. And hopefully, now, as you say, golf can try and capitalize on that interest and attention in the years ahead. Over on kind of from the positive side of that, we go over now, Carlos, to the kind of the murky sort of corporate deal nonsense that you get behind the scenes, which is quite entertaining in its own way. I've seen Costco, which is obviously a huge, huge company, and it's Acushnet, which is the parent company of Titleist and FootJoy. They've been kind of a dispute for since the end of last year in December, when Acushnet actually reportedly sent a letter to Costco accusing the retailer, the massive retailer, of patent infringement and false advertising. And Costco have now responded with a lawsuit, which has led to a countersuit from Acushnet. So it's all happening here. And as I say, so 5 months ago, sorry, 5 months after Costco filed a lawsuit against Acushnet to make Titleist golf balls, seeking a judgment that its popular Kirkland brand balls did not violate Titleist's patents. Acushnet has fired back with its own countersuit against the retail giant, and over 284 pages of, you know, legal speak. Titleist alleges essentially that the Costco ball infringes upon 10 of its patents related to ball core and dimple. So Costco's own ball is kind of apparently infringing on Titleist's technology and so on. But Acushnet is not seeking a specific dollar amount in reparation, but is requesting adequate damages, whatever that means, including three times the profits that Costco has made on its Kirkland branded bottle. And it's also suing Costco for false advertising of its brand, specifically the Kirkland signature guarantee that promises to meet or exceed the quality standards of leading national brands. That, of course, has offended Titleist and its parent company. And in the complaint, Akushnet has said, the type of Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls have all these characteristics demonstrably superior to the Kirkland Signature golf ball, despite Costco's claim that its ball meets or exceeds the quality standards of the leading national brands. A Acushnet company has performed testing that conclusively shows that Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls are superior to the Kirkland Signature golf ball in performance and durability, and thus that Costco's Kirkland Signature guarantee is false with respect to its golf ball products. And Acushnet is now requesting a jury trial. So, Carlos, this has been going on for a few months now. These two big, you know, monstrous corporations are kind of having a bit of a spat with each other, which is kind of silly and a bit entertaining. But I have to say, I've never heard of Costco's Kirkland Signature golf ball. I've got to say, you know, Titleist Pro V1's obviously the best-known golf ball in golf. So it's a new story on me, so it'll be fun to see just how it goes down. But in the end, of course, you know, Titleist are feeling quite offended by, of course, Costco being kind of exuberant with their advertising, I guess you can say. But who knows? In the end, I think as we all know, really, Callaway golf balls are the best, aren't they? So that's, you know, all this Titleist and Costco rubbish. You know, Callaway golf balls are actually the best. You know, every real golfer knows that.
Why are we even bothering about the Acushnet
exactly,
and the Titleist?
Right. Who cares if Titleist have to say to anything?
Who cares? I mean, just do what I do. I'm just sitting back, getting my popcorn and reading about it, because that's what it looks
exactly
like a movie. it's amazing. But hey, more power to them. They have money to spend and sue each other. So we here talk about it, have something else to talk. With that, we wrap up our Par 5 news. And now we're going to have our practice range for every week. We pick a topic, and each of us have our own shots at it. And Kieran, I know you can talk like an hour and a half about the FedEx Cup. And I know that of the 90 minutes, maybe 89 would be about why isn't that good. But let's see. You know, the FedEx Cup, I know it's true, right? You would talk 89 about why it isn't good, right? Yeah, I'm not wrong about that, right? Okay, good. Okay.
No,
I know
you are absolutely right, yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, FedEx Cup is a championship trophy for the PGA Tour. But more than that, it was introduced first in 2007. It was announced back in November 2005. It's a way that for the first time, men's professional golf had a kind of a playoff system. Why is that? Well, the top 125 players, the ultimate goal is to be among the top 125 points leaders following the final event of the regular season. Only those players who are regular full-time members of the PGA Tour will be earning points. A non-member who joins the PGA Tour mid-season will be eligible to earn points in the first event he plays after officially joining the tour. Now, after that final event of the regular season, like I said, the top 125 participate in the playoffs. The number of points awarded for each winning playoff event is 2,000 points, which is four times the amount awarded for a typical regular season tournament. Points won in playoff events are added to those for the regular season, and the fields are reduced as the playoffs proceed. You know, starting in 2013, the top 125 on the points list will also be retaining their tour cards for the following season. Let's say it starts with the Northern Trust, where the top 125 leaders after the Wyndham Championship will be played. Then the top 100-point leaders after this, the Northern Trust, which starts this week, will play at the Dell Technologies Championship. Both of these tournaments, the Northern Trust and the Dell Technologies Championships, have a 36-hole cut to the top 70 players plus ties. Now, after the Dell Technologies Championship, the top 70-points leaders will move to the BMW Championship. That doesn't have a cut. And neither does the Tour Championship, which is the last event where only the top 30 points leaders after the BMW Championship will be playing. Now, in the FedEx Cup playoffs, they are
anything like the PGA Tour's regular season this year, golf fans are in for quite a ride. When Justin Thomas claimed his first major title 2 weeks ago in the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow, it was his fourth victory of the season. That moved him ahead of world number one Dustin Johnson, second-ranked Hideki Matsuyama of Japan, and third-ranked Jordan Spieth, who all have won three times on the PGA Tour. The last time four players won three or more times in the season on the circuit was in 2003, when Tiger Woods led the way with five titles. The fearsome foursome will be trying to add to their totals this week in the Northern Trust, which is the first of four legs in the FedEx Cup playoffs at the Glen Oaks Club in Old Westbury, New York. But before we go to who's in and what we expect there, I ask you, Kieran, I mean, I know the FedEx Cup doesn't hold a big chunk of your heart, but you have to admit it has influenced other tours into creating something similar to it. There's the race to the CME Globe in the LPGA, the race to Dubai in the European Tour, the road to Oman in the Challenge Tour, and there's also the Web.com Tour Finals, the Charles Schwab Cup in the Champions Tour. Gotta admit, I mean, there's something good about it when other tours are really copying that.
Yeah, you could argue that point, Carlos, and I think it's a point well made. That, yes, other tours have tried to follow that and adopt that for themselves. I think the reason for that is it gives them a kind of defined end of season, and also it's very good for sponsorship because a big company like FedEx, for example, loves just having their name branded about every week of every year, building towards the end of season, so it makes perfect sense from that standpoint. But no, the FedEx Cup does not have a big place in my heart, nor really anyone's heart. I don't think anyone cares who wins the FedEx Cup. I would sit an average person down and ask them who won the last five FedEx Cups. They have no idea. They don't care. Ask them who wins the Masters or the Open Championship, they may have a chance of getting that right, because in the end, for those events, the majors, it's about the titles. Trophy, that's what matters most. The FedEx in the end is just a case of guys trying to get some late season glory and get some spending money for their winter break. That's what it pretty much is, rich guys getting richer. That said, Carlos, and you're quite right there, over the years I've been coming onto this show, which is 4 years now, believe it or not, I've ranted about the FedEx Cup, I've written about it, I've criticised it, I've kind of called it a game show for golf. However, for the past couple of years, I started to enjoy it a little bit more, believe it or not. Right?
Stop the presses. Repeat.
Yeah, I know that's a real shocking statement, but just let me finish. I've started enjoying it more now that I don't take it in any way seriously. I've decided that it doesn't matter, that it's unimportant, that I shouldn't even care about it. And since doing that, Carlos, I started to enjoy it more because in the end, yeah, you know, it's four events, it's got a great field every week, the best players are playing. That's always good. I enjoy watching that. I don't really care about the points and who's ranking where and all the permutations, always buried this way, who was at number five and number four, who's in the top 10, who's here. I don't care about all that. No one does. It's too hard to follow. You know, but in terms of just great golf tournaments, it's four great weeks. You know, we have the best players playing, you know, good venues. I'm looking forward to seeing the course this week in New York, which is apparently the Augusta of the North, is what they call it. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. So, yeah, I think in the end, Carlos, I don't particularly care about it. I don't think it's really resonated deeply with golf fans, despite what the PGA Tour had to say about it. But in terms of putting on kind of an end-of-season show, in terms of getting us four big events, in terms of kind of putting an end to the season, I think it has been beneficial. I think you can argue that the format and different things altogether, but I think, you know, the principle of it, yeah, it's just about rich guys getting richer, but, you know, in the end, it's four great weeks of golf. And even someone like me, even a grouchy person like me, Carlos, a real cynical person like me, you know, I can kind of push that aside and just say, the FedEx Cup, yeah, you know, it is what it is. But I'll try my best to enjoy it this year.
Okay, I mean, that's a good way of seeing it. It's like you say, it's a way of seeing the best players play together 4 weeks in a row. I really argue that the format is what I don't like. Yeah, I understand you're getting caught, and that's the play of format, right? But I just don't like that part. What I really don't like is that wraparound season from the PGA. I still can't get it after they finish here. It's like I have to see who wins the rest of the tournaments because we have a show to talk about, but after that is football season here in the States. And by the way, I know who the last four who won is Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, Billy Horschel, and Henrik Stenson. So, yeah, I do know that. So it's not that bad.
Carlos, you are not an average golf fan. You are an expert. You study this. You talk about it every week. You go and grab some guy from a bar. He doesn't even know what a FedEx Cup is. Never mind who won it.
Now, they'll say, is that something in the bar that they're offering? I mean, can we go there and drink it? No, that's not what Freddie
is. No, why not? That's probably where Fred is right now. He should go and join him.
He should be. Who knows? I mean, knowing him at this time of the day, yeah, probably that's what he's enjoying now, a good cup. Or like you say it there in your country, a good pint, right? That's what it is.
Yeah,
a good pint. All right. So anyway, just let's talk about who's in and who's out. I mean, I already said a little bit on the recap of the Wyndham Championship, but definitely that top 125 got settled this past week. There was a lot of movement, especially J.J. Henry was the one who went inside the bubble. There he was outside the 134th and moved into 125. Jeff Ogilvy was there in 125. He made a big move to 116. Also, other players that went in from outside were big moves, 21 spots by Martin Flores from 139 to 118. Also, from way outside, Roddy Sabatini. Man, what a tournament he had there, 65, 68, 66, and 64. He definitely earned those that 122nd place to get into that into the FedEx Cup playoffs. Also, Harold Varner the third came out of nowhere also to get there into the 125. But the top players that are going to be here, those are the ones that we have to talk about because those are the best players right now playing. Of course, Rory McIlroy is the defending champion, but just a couple of weeks ago, he said, you know, he might not make it here. He'll be a force here, definitely, as long as his body cooperates. He's the 44th seed, but that shouldn't last long. I mean, he's going to be concentrated on this series, and he's somebody to see and look about. Hideki Matsuyama, I think if I don't talk about him, you should say that I am. There's an imposter here talking. It's definitely not me. But he's the FedEx Cup points leader. He's a machine everywhere he competes. He has two top fives among four top 15s in the majors this season. He was a runaway winner recently at Firestone. He had the lead with nine to go at the PGA Championship. He blew it. I think that he's out for revenge and try to get. So he's just definitely a force to be reckoned with here. Jordan Spieth, the number three seed, unlikely. He will miss the cut twice as he did when he captured the 2015 FedEx Cup. But this year he has almost paralleled that season. So he's somebody to look forward to doing good here. Ricky Fowler, DJ, Brooks Koepka, Henrik Stenson. He's always getting hot at the end of the year. I don't know why, but it's like he starts so slow and then starts building up. And he is always a force to be reckoned with at the end of the season. There are some other players like Justin Thomas. I mean, since player of the year isn't quite decided yet, he can eliminate the doubt with a win here. I mean, seated second to start. He's a four-time winner this season. He will have a month worth of opportunities. Other players that are playing really well, Daniel Berger. I mean, he's playing really well. First two spins in the playoffs with top 15s in eight events. He was a runner-up at Conway Farms in 2015, so he's number eight seed, but he's one to look. Paul Casey, I mean, he is really under the radar, I would say. He's been super consistent, phenomenal form, and close out last year's playoffs, second, and fourth. He's somebody I have to look forward to seeing here. Matt Kuchar, hard to believe he's only 15th in points, but he really didn't come on until mid-May. Patrick Reed, he's winless since 2016 Northern Trust at Betfair's Black, but he's crashing in at number 38. So, and that T2 at the PGA Championship seems to be looking that he's on the upwards. Francesco Molinari is still a non-winner on tour, but he's having a career season here. So there are a lot of good players. Jason Day, I mean, we've known his year. It's been challenging for him. He's 49th right now, but he's with a bit of steam. That T9 at the PGA Championship shows that he's really getting into form, and he could be riding at the top form right at the Tour Championship. John Rahm, of course, I've been talking about him all year. He's the ultimate wild card. Would he have his mind on it or not? That's the key. I mean, first-year PGA Tour member, he's making his playoff debut at rank 6. His only quantifiable weakness is his inexperience, but he's grinding away at that too. But I think he needs to get his mind a little more mature. So what you think about who's in and who's out and what you're looking forward this year? And other thing that I would like to ask you about is, do you think that this format on the FedEx Cup favors any of these players? Or, I mean, is this format good, or would you change anything about it?
I think the players I look at for the FedEx Cup are the guys who perhaps haven't had the greatest seasons, or the guys who are perhaps looking for something to prove, and this is kind of the last chance to do it this year. And you mentioned Rory McIlroy there and Jason Day, obviously two of the world's great players who, for different reasons, haven't had the greatest of seasons. And this is really their last chance to come through and do something meaningful, to win big events and to beat the best players and to pick up a trophy at the end of it, and obviously a big prize fund. But we saw Rory do that last year when he came through and won it, and I think we could see something like that again. Obviously, Rory's had an unpredictable year, up and down, a lot of changes to his game and his life, and he hasn't, you know, obviously the injuries are still potentially there, the rib injury, so he's going to try and defend his FedEx Cup, but, you know, how will that play out, we don't really know. And like you said there, Matsuyama, I think I agree with you. I think he has something to prove after the PGA, where he obviously got into a great position, just seemed to know what it was, the kind of the situation. He put too much pressure on himself, but he just didn't quite handle it very well. Looked very flustered. But he's also number one in the ranking right now. But I actually look at the guys who are kind of on the third on the list, who have to try and work their way up towards the top 30 to get into Eastlake in the Tour Championship. Those guys have something to really play for week to week. The guys in the top 10, top 15, they're pretty much assured of being in the 4 weeks. They perhaps don't quite have the same immediacy or urgency to their game or their mentality. So I look at the guys who are further down this week and also in the weeks ahead to try and really push ahead and try and make up ground. And those are the guys to look out for. Obviously, in the past, we've seen, you know, Billy Horschel did that so well a few years ago, and winning a couple of the events and during the playoffs and so on. You know, guys like that who, you know, they start way down. I think Billy Horschel was down maybe 70th in the ranking. You know, Rory was in the 30s last year at the start of it, and they came right through and won it. So I look at those guys, the guys who are further down, as being potentially the ones to watch. And the guys have something to prove. In terms of the format, I'm not sure it favours anyone necessarily. I think in the end, it favours the guys who are further down because they have to play well. They have to keep themselves involved, have to keep progressing in the ranking. So it gives them kind of an extra bit of motivation to try and go out and play really well. Again, perhaps the guys in the top 5 or 10 don't really have to. They'll be there for the last event anyway. And would I change anything about it? I've always been kind of sniffy about the idea of the points reset, because I've always said that technically, on the rules of the FedEx Cup, one guy, or obviously it would never happen, but one guy could literally win every single event on the season, finish second in the Tour Championship, and not win the FedEx Cup. And obviously that's never going to happen. But to me, it just shows a real flaw with the idea of just setting everybody, no matter what happens, on the last event, everybody's positioned on the same points, no matter what, every year. So to me, you win 15 times, 10 times, win four majors, you're still not number one necessarily. And I've always had issue with that. However, I kind of understand in kind of the game show format of it all, you have to try and create, artificially create interest about it. And that's kind of why I don't take it seriously, because in the end, to me, it's not such a genuine competition. It's just, it's a game show. It's just invented. You get through one round, you sit back at the beginning again. Another round, back at the beginning again. So I find it hard to take it seriously for that reason. But they're never going to change it because, you know, they've had it for the last few years now. It seems to work. I think then we judge it on who wins the FedEx Cup. When Bill Haas won it from nowhere, we sort of thought, well, where'd that come from? He didn't deserve to win that. Or when Snedeker won it, you know, it was a bit of a surprise there as well. But when guys like Rory win it or Jordan Spieth win it, you know, we start to think a bit better of the FedEx. So if, I don't know, if somehow, if like Dustin Johnson wins or Hideki Matsuyama or Justin Thomas, then we'll think, well, you know, that's pretty good. But if, I don't know, if Lucas Glover comes through and wins the FedEx Cup, we might start thinking, really? You know, does that really happen? But of course it could happen. So, Carlos, in the end, when it comes to FedEx Cup, you know, I said earlier, it gives us four great events, great fields, but in terms of the overall competition, I find it hard to care about it because I don't think it actually means anything. You know, genuinely, I do not think it means anything. I don't think the title means anything. You know, the prize fund, great for the guys, but in terms of as viewers, we don't really care about it either. For me, you know, in the end, it's the majors, even big events, they matter more because it's about the title. It's about the trophy. It's about the prestige. And I just do not think the FedEx Cup has that prestige yet. Maybe it will in the future. I doubt it. Funnily enough, I actually think the individual events have bigger prestige than the overall title does, which I think is a sort of a fundamental flaw of it. So, I'm not sure about you, Carlos, but I still don't like the points reset for the Tour Championship, but I can't see them ever changing it.
Yeah, I don't see it either. It's the way that they have reached it that way right now, and they seem pretty subtle until something, I think, controversial would come. Then they would consider it. For now, I think that's what we're stuck with. And I think that part of the problem that this has, I understand the playoffs is just like any other competition where, let's say, and I know this is not a big sport there in your side, but American football, and let's go some years back when the New England Patriots went 18-0 to the Super Bowl, lost in the final in the Super Bowl, and what happened to that 18-0? You know, it's like it went out. So it's the same thing that happens here. It's a playoff system, and I think the determinant here is that, let's say, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Billy Horschel came from 69 to win. Brent Snedeker was 19th and he won. Billy Haas was 15th and he won. So even though Jordan Spieth was first, and he won it. That was his year. Henrik Stenson, everybody knew that year. He was just the hottest player in the world coming in there, even though he was ninth. So that, but take away those two, and the rest of the seasons have been players coming from out of the cloud. So that's what I think that for, it's just who's better this month. That is what it's all about. And that's why I don't think it's really worth it to be named something so big. It's somebody that played great for 4 weeks, and that's it. I mean, he could have been one of the best players, but some of the time, if somebody that's out of it, or at least near the top, who just gets red hot and wins it. So I'm thinking this week, this month, I mean, Paul Casey, somebody that's been playing outstanding and superbly consistent. That's a guy that's coming from outside that I'm be looking at, and he can get hot anytime and win his year. I think this year he should be there contending from the outside of the top players. But, of course, Hideki Matsuyama is going to be my pick. So, anyway, any final comments before we go to Fred's interview and then our final part?
Just to say that I think, you know, obviously Hideki Matsuyama is going to win the FedEx Cup, but I'm pretty sure that Sergio Garcia is going to finish second. Isn't that right, Carlos?
And John Ram will be third. That's how it's
going to be. John Ram will be third, yeah.
Yeah, that's how it is. Yes. Well, with that, we wrap up our practice range. That's our preview of the FedEx Cup playoffs. Now it's Fred Stern and his interview with Ben Wright. So it's about 12 minutes. It'll take us to almost 5 minutes to go before we leave. So let's get right into it.
Hi, guys. Sorry I can't be with you this evening. You know I couldn't stay away. Proving to you that I've been out there working, anything for the show. I know you think I'm just playing golf, but I'm really working. And I'm bringing you a really wonderful interview tonight. We had the opportunity to meet Ben Wright, have dinner with him up in northern Michigan last week. And from that, he was accommodating enough to sit down and tape a short interview with us. And I have that for you this evening. And, of course, you know, Ben worked for nearly 30 years for CBS Sports. He covered every big event that CBS held during that time. In addition to being a great TV announcer, he also has been a golf writer since 1954. The first golf tournament he ever saw was watching Ben Hogan win the Open Championship at Carnoustie in 1953. So Ben has been there, seen it, done it. He had some wonderful insight into some of the history of golf over the years. We had a delightful discussion. And he talks a little bit in this interview about Ben Hogan. He also talks about Jack Nicklaus. And he talks a little bit about talking with Bobby Jones on slow play and the penalties that should be given out for that before Bobby's death. So, guys, I hope you enjoy this. And, Kieran, I want you to understand this is a right proper interview just for you. So, guys, have a great show.
We are here talking with Ben Wright. That's correct, Ben Wright, who used to work for CBS as announcer, has written for golf for over 50 years, been around the world, seen it all, been there, done that, from Hogan and Snead clear up to today. Mr. Wright, it's truly a pleasure talking with you this evening.
Thank you very much indeed.
We are here in Michigan. Northern Michigan. What brings you to Michigan in August?
Well, I have a tournament in my name at the Crystal Mountain Resort, which was named after me because I hit a fluke shot in a shootout to win it in the inaugural Crystal Mountain Invitational. So they asked me if they could name the event after me, and I had no reason to say no, and it's been a wonderful thing for me because this is the 13th year, and I've made so many lasting friendships with people like Chuck Babel, you know, who we just had dinner with and who brought me here. It's been a joy to come to Upper Michigan, and my wife and I drove from Crystal Mountain up to Northport and back today, which was 157 miles. And we see as much of the countryside as we can and love it here. Absolutely love it.
You didn't stop at any of the good vineyards up there on the peninsula, did you?
Not this time. We went to Two Lads last Sunday up on the old Mission Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And had a high old time there. Very nice place, as a matter of fact.
Ben, you told a wonderful story at dinner about witnessing one of the first golf events that you ever went to. You were in the military in England, and you skipped out to go watch a tournament. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I was stationed at Crail, Scotland, which is close to St. Andrews, and it actually boasts the fourth oldest golf course in the British Isles. And I had read how Mr. Hogan had said he was coming over to win the British Open at Carnoustie and would never return to defend it. And I thought, that's a pretty arrogant kind of thing to say. So I was fascinated, and I borrowed the car that five of us had bought for anything but a princely sum, and drove over, got lodgings in the village of Carnoustie for £4 for the week, and latched onto Mr. Hogan and watched every shot he hit in practice and every shot he hit in the championship in which he scored 73-71. And on the final day, which was a Friday in those days, because in Britain we didn't have any touring pros, they had to be back at their places of occupation to keep their jobs for the weekend. It was a religious experience for me because I never saw before or since such command over the golf ball, such an incredible precision in everything he did. It became a religious experience, and I went back to the base and I told my colleagues who allowed me to take the car and had covered for me, had told the authorities I had a communicable disease and should not be disturbed.
That's a great story. And so from there you decided you needed to get in the golf riding business.
Exactly. Being fortunate enough to do so, still writing, still broadcasting, started in 1954, and I'm still broadcasting today, and for money.
People still pay you. That's the best part, isn't it? Ben, we were talking a little bit about, I asked you what was one of the most remarkable events that you saw on the golf course, and of course, you referred back to 1986 and Jack Nicklaus at the Masters.
Yes. Well, it was, absolutely, because Jack had been written off. In fact, a colleague of mine from Atlanta, Tom McCollister, wrote a column in the Atlanta Journal Constitution saying that Jack had seen better days and could not be in amongst the favorites to be considered for that Masters. And, of course, he had a lot of ground to make up in the final round. And when he bogeyed number 12 in an inward half of 30, I thought he might have blown it, because for a lot of people in pursuit, Seve Ballesteros, Greg Norman, Tom Kite. And when he came to 15, it was plain to me that he had to get a birdie at worst.
And 15 was the hole that you were broadcasting?
Yes, I broadcast it for over 20 years, actually 25. So I was broadcasting at that hole, and I remember so vividly that when he made the eagle putt, the noise was so ear-splitting that I couldn't hear what my boss, Frank Chikinian, was telling me to do. I laid out, and I said nothing after, "Yes, sir," when he held the club, "there's life in the old bear yet." And I laid out and followed him all the way to the 16th tee and then handed it over. But the noise was still tremendous. It was absolutely... I worked for CBS for 27 years and never was I unable to hear my boss. So it was something that was so special. The others started to fall apart because with each remarkable feat, I mean, he nearly holed in one at 16, made the birdie putt, as you well know, at 17. I mean, the noise was, it had to be heard to be believed.
Was there ever a tournament that you enjoyed doing more than working at Augusta National for every year for the Masters?
No. I loved it very dearly. There's something about that tournament. It is as well run as any golf event has ever been. And I include the British because I think the British Open is extremely well run and a lot better run than the U.S. counterpart. And I'm sorry, just have to say that. Yes, that was my favorite. Pebble Beach came a pretty close second, as a matter of fact, because such a magnificent setting, and I had the good fortune to play a lot of golf at Cypress Point, which is like dying and going to heaven.
Absolutely. You actually became good friends with Bobby Jones, Clifford Roberts. You have some deep roots at Augusta National.
I do indeed. And in fact, Mr. Jones, who I first met in 1958 at St. Andrews for the inaugural Eisenhower Trophy, that four-man amateur team event, when he was the non-playing captain of the American team. And they flew over a golf cart for him because he had been horribly crippled by that time. And that was the first golf cart I ever saw. And I never saw another one until I came to America. Mr. Jones summoned me to what turned out to be his deathbed in his cottage at Augusta. And didn't even say good morning. He said, "Young Wright," he said, "your column on Saturday," which was in the Financial Times of London, which he read slavishly week after week, month after month. He said, "You said that golf professionals should be penalized by two strokes for slow play." And I said, "Well, Mr. Jones, you and I both know that that is slow play is the cancer that will destroy this game if anything ever does." And he said, "Yes, I do recognize that. But don't you realize you might send a man into a tailspin, totally destroy his career?" And I said, "Well, yes, I do. But we've got to do something about it. You know that, Mr. Jones, as well as I do." And Jones said, as clear his mind was as sharp as a steel trap. He said, "I'll give him one." He wanted a one-stroke penalty rather than two. And I think probably in retrospect, that's probably about right.
We've been talking with Ben Wright, former CBS announcer, still out there covering golf, writing, up to date. Brilliant discussion tonight. Thank you so much, Mr. Wright.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
There you have it. That was Ben Wright. And any quick comments, Kieran, before we go to our final pass about Ben Wright?
Compliment Fred and a very good interview there. You know, Ben Wright has a wonderful experience in the game, and there's so much history there, and he expresses himself so articulately and just so wonderfully English, doesn't he? He has a tremendous way of talking and an inimitable style. So actually, he's so good at talking, we should get him on the show full time, shouldn't we?
He can take Fred's place, right?
Oh, no, definitely, absolutely.
Hey, it's the final parts. I'm going to go quick over this. Sangmun Bae took his first steps back into civilian life on Wednesday after completing his mandatory stint in the South Korean military. And he was the last 21 months he spent as a rifleman in the Army, honoring the requirement for all able-bodied Korean men between ages of 18 and 35 to undertake military service as deterrent to North Korean aggression. He plans to return to professional golf at next month's Shinhan Donghae Open, which is co-sanctioned by the Asian Tour and the Korean PGA. And on my final pod, the American Junior Golf Association and the Jordan Spieth Family Foundation were pleased to announce the Jordan Spieth Family Foundation Achieving Competitive Excellence ACE Grant Endowment. That endowment will offer opportunities to Texas junior golfers to compete at a national level. Junior golf is one of the four pillars of the Jordan Spieth Family Foundation, which also lends time, helps grow awareness, and offers financial support to special needs, youth, military families, and pediatric cancer. And with that, Kieran, he will join a list of other professional golfers who have endowed ACE grants, like Annika Sørenstam, Jimmy and Aaron Walker, Patrick and Justin Reed, Hunter Mahan, and Gianni Tsang.
Yes, Carlos, and over my final putts, I have Stuart Sink, who is, of course, a six-time PGA Tour winner and the 2009 Open champion. And he was named the recipient of a 2017 Payne Stuart Award in recognition of his charity, character, and sportsmanship. Stuart's one of the most popular players in the PGA Tour of all the guys, and one of the nicest guys on the circuit. And he will be honored on September 19th in a televised ceremony on the Golf Channel prior to the Tour Championship. And a very well-deserved honor for Sink, who, of course, embodies many of the great qualities that Payne Stuart, the late, great Payne Stuart, had before his death in 1999. And that player who received an award was Leona Maguire from Ireland, who won the Mark H. McCormick Medal for the third consecutive year as the leading women's player in the world amateur golf ranking. Leona Maguire is just an amazing talent. She won the ladies' British amateur this season and also finished joint runner-up in 2017 NCAA Championship individual standing. She's 22 years old. She will shortly begin her final year at Duke University, and we can expect her to have a fantastic future in the game going forward. She's a wonderful talent. And over on the flip side of age, over in Florida, a very nice story about Joe Sepik, who turns 100 years old. He plays at Cypress Lakes Golf Course in St. Petersburg, and he plays in a Tuesday morning 9-hole week, and he plays a Friday 18-hole round. He's 100 years old. He's played golf since he was 12 years of age. He's still going strong, and his secret to long life is apparently never drinking, never smoking, and eating a banana once a day. So that's the secret. But of course, Carlos, at 100 years of age, Joe is still one of the youngest people in Florida.
Hey, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, Ben Wright. But even more special to the one and only, our friend and colleague, Kieran Clark, for once again being a key part of the show, taking over for Fred while he's sacrificing playing golf around the country for the benefit of the show. Kieran's, with your excellence, you'll make golf media great again. So thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
So thank you, Kieran. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Block Talk Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or TuneIn. Also, you can see us on Roku TV. And if you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres. Along with Kieran Clark, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Thank you, guys. Cheers.
What you doing?
Ran out of space on my phone, so I'm deleting some stuff. Bye, singing dog. Bye, goal.
I pronounce you.
Bye, wedding ceremony.
Stop. At Metro PCS, you get two free phones with twice as much memory.
Really? Don't say bye to your memories. Switch to Metro PCS and get two free LG K20 Plus phones with 32 gigs when you switch two lines. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.
What you doing?
Ran out of space on my phone, so I'm deleting some stuff. Bye, singing dog. Bye, goal.
I pronounce you.
Bye, wedding ceremony.
Stop. At Metro PCS, you get two free phones with twice as much memory.
Really? Don't say bye to your memories. Switch to Metro PCS and get two free LG K20 Plus phones with 32 gigs when you switch two lines. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.